Welcome to the committee. So, folks, we're on the policy bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Beth Cadoon.
Can you pull your mic up a little bit? We're not hearing you too well.
Is that better?
Better, thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Beth Cadoon. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Revenue. Per the request of Madam Chair, and I think so we can make sure we can get to the people who want to testify on our bill, we'll start with House File 2972, which is our policy bill. At the request of the chair last year, we split our bill this year between our two bills, one more of a technical housekeeping bill and another a policy bill where we thought there might be a little more controversy or comments regarding it. This will all be our non-budget related provisions. Any of our budget provisions are carried in the governor's supplemental budget, and I know that's on the schedule for next week. With that, I'll turn it over to the attorneys to walk through, and we'll try to be brief so that we can get to, like I said, the testimony.
Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mark Peterson. I'm an attorney with the Department of Revenue. I'll be going through Section 1 of the bill, or Article 1 of the bill, excuse me. Section 1, under the law, all taxpayers who withhold income tax from payments are required to issue statements to the folks that are paying. The most common form of that is a W-2 or a 1099. And all taxpayers who withhold tax are required to send in an annual reconciliation to the Department of Revenue, submitting those W-2s or 1099s that show the withholding. And all that reconciliation is done on one form to the department and all on file at the same time. Now, many persons who issue these statements are required to file those 1099s and W-2s electronically to the Department of Revenue. And those electronic filing thresholds have been dropping in recent years. There are 50 for statements are required to be filed this February. It drops to 25 for statements that are required to be filed next year and 10 in 2011 and thereafter. And those thresholds are not being changed. We're getting rid of some obsolete language for old years and that. But what this change does is it clarifies for purposes of determining whether the electronic filing thresholds are met is that all the W-2s and 1099s that are issued are aggregated in determining whether the threshold is met. Section 2 amends the law so that the mailing a notice of refund will stop the running of interest if the department determines that an address is no longer valid or is in not current. Under current law, the mailing of the warrant itself actually stops the running of interest. Now, the reason that we're proposing this is our experience from last year when we were told by the Postal Service that in order to get the best postal rates, we had to run old addresses through a change of address service to make a determination that the addresses were still valid. And that applies generally when the address we have is more than 60 or 90 days old. And that meant rent refunds and homeowner refunds, because those are typically filed during the income tax filing season, and the rent refunds aren't paid until August, and the homeowner refunds aren't paid until September. Now, we found about 700 refunds and about $250,000 of refunds that were sent that we had bad addresses for. And what we're proposing is that we send this the notice out saying that we're required under current law, we're required to say how much a refund is and what we've done on a refund claim. Most times that comes with the actual warrant. So, you know, if you've ever had refunds, you get a little stub that says you asked for $700. Allowed refund $700. That's the notice that we would send out to these folks that we've determined is have a bad address. There'd also be instructions on what to do if they're to get their refunds. We really don't want to send the warrants out. Now, some of these will end up getting forwarded, even though the post office has told, or somebody has told us there is no forwarding address. Oftentimes, these letters will end up at somebody's house or apartment where the folks actually, the taxpayer knows the people, so they'll get it anyways. We think it's more prudent to do that than to send the warrants out just because, you know, we're sending these warrants to addresses that are no good with a possibility of theft of the refunds. That's Article 1.
I'm going to ask Representative Loeffler if she can move the bill and if Ms. Dalton can, or Ms. somebody can get the right amendments here. We have not moved the bill, and we have a few amendments Revenue wants us to add to get this in front of us in the order they would like it. Is that right? No?
Yes.
These amendments are not from the department?
They're technical.
Yes.
Technical bill.
I'm sure, yes.
They're not to the policy bill, they're to the technical bill?
Yes.
Okay, so we need to move the policy bill, though.
Madam Chair, I'd move the written recommend to pass House File 2972 to the floor, I believe, is where it goes.
No, to layover for possible inclusion.
Okay, this one doesn't have...
Okay, so there's a motion to put the bill before us. Discussion, all those in favor say aye. Aye, opposed say nay. Okay, so that was Article 1. Article 2.
I'm Susan Berry from the Department of Revenue. I'll do Article 2.
I apologize. Representative Loffler.
Madam Chair and to our guests, on that last item where there's an invalid tax address, I'm just thinking in these tough times when so many rental properties as well as homeowner properties are going into foreclosure, people are having to move with short notice, there's a lot of chaos in sort of the residential market more than we've seen in the past. Is there a listing on the department's website or on the Department of Commerce unclaimed property? Or, I mean, is there a way that someone who's moved, you've got a bad address, can actually look this up if they know they have something coming?
Madam Chair, Senator, there's not really an immediate list of refunds that are sitting there. I mean, there's data privacy concerns with issuing a list like that. You know, we have in the instructions, if you have change of address, call us and let us know. Additionally, we have people who actually do try to find the addresses for the people. Oftentimes that doesn't happen until they file another return with us. My experience, though, I used to work at the department in the phone room during the filing season, and I can tell you that a lot of people are aware that they've got a refund coming, and they know it's going to be coming at a particular time, and they call the department saying, where's my refund? But we don't have in October, for instance, issue a list of rent refunds that have been sent back to us in the last 6 weeks.
Okay. Representative Loffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just so that the rest of the committee knows, our staff was just informing that there is a quick lookup on the website where you can actually enter in your own information and find out the status of your refund.
Okay.
That's correct.
Thank you. Thank you. Article 2. Any other questions on Article 1? Article 2.
All right. Sales and use tax. The first section is regarding the refund of sales tax to sellers on behalf of purchasers. Under the current law, if the vendor has collected from the purchaser and remitted sales tax on a transaction that's not subject to sales tax, then they can get that money back and refund it to the purchaser. However, the current law does not include a timeline for by when they must remit that back to the or credit the purchaser, and this proposal will provide that within 60 days after the commissioner issues the refund, any amount that they've not refunded or credited to the purchaser must be returned to the commissioner so that it would go back into the general fund. Section 2 and 3 provides seller and purchaser relief from liability. And this is an amendment that's made to conform to the streamlined sales tax agreement. It will provide that if there are not at least 30 days between the enactment of a new sales tax rate and the effective date of the new rate, then for up to 30 days, sellers will be relieved from liability to the state for failing to collect the tax at the new rate. This means that they would have to continue to collect the former tax rate. They wouldn't be able to collect no tax. And also, they would not be able to solicit purchasers at the old rate. And then there's similar relief for purchasers. Now, we don't expect this to be an issue in Minnesota as far as giving retailers at least 30 days notice of a rate change, having that in the law. But the practicality is that if 30 days are not, at least 30 days are not allowed for the retailers to make this rate change, most of them would not be able to comply in time. So 30 days is a good idea, as well as being something to conform to streamlined sales tax. Section 4.
Ms. Berry?
Yes.
I apologize, Your Honor, just to interrupt you for a second and ask Ms. Dalton, if she's here, if there is anything else in streamline that the committee needs to adopt this year beyond what the Department of Revenue is recommending to keep us in compliance. If you want to pull up a table, I mean, chair, quick. I want members to, you know, members may not know that Ms. Dalton is quite an expert in this area and has been really a leader in the whole streamlined sales, and we're booking money for it, and we're all still working as a collection of states on this issue, and I just want to make sure that Minnesota is doing everything it needs to do from the House's perspective. Ms. Dalton.
For the record, I'm Pat Dalton with House Research. Madam Chair, members of the committee, there is one other provision that I'm aware of that we need to do something about in order to maintain our compliance, and that is currently this state taxes ringtones, and ringtones are part of the definition of digital audio products. To remain in compliance come, I think it's September 1, we either have to exempt ringtones from sales tax or we have to start taxing all digital audio products. It will have either a revenue cost or a revenue increase. And that's why it's that in these bills.
So just a little non-controversial provision. Okay, that's good to know, Representative Broad.
Madam Chair, I'm just not sure if the folks on the tape saw Representative Dabney doing a jig over there.
Yes, Representative Coles, please.
Madam Chair, Ms. Dalton, what if we exempted ringtones, do you have any... Have you seen any estimates from the department, or do you know approximately what the impact to revenues would be?
And Ms. Templin is behind Ms. Dalton in case she has very detailed revenue estimates, but I...
For the record, Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Staff. There is, the Department of Revenue did issue a revenue estimate, and I can get that from my office and distribute it for the hearing.
Do you have a rough idea?
Off the top of my head, I believe it's about $500,000 in a revenue loss.
If we conform, it's a loss, and if we...
Cost, yes.
So we're a minus, to the minus, if we conform.
If we exempt.
Okay. And so the committee is going to have to make that decision, and of course, if we don't make a decision, we're making a decision. But just wanted to get that one up there so that we just know everything we have to do with streamlined sales. So thank you, Ms. Berry. You were on Section 4, Article 2.
Section 4. This is a provision to lessen administrative compliance burdens and complexity for new or amended special local taxes. We're asking that they use the definitions that are found in the sales tax chapter for any special local laws. And these are laws other than local sales tax laws. These are laws such as lodging, entertainment, admissions, or food and beverage taxes that the department either has agreed to or perhaps would be required to under special law. So this would be for those laws that either enacted or amended after 2009 that would grant a local government unit or a group authority to impose the local tax other than a sales tax, as long as the department would be administering the tax.
Excuse me, Ms. Berry, Representative Marquardt, were you tracking that one there? I'm just sort of curious on, so in the department knows there's a moratorium on any local option sales taxes or even discussing them or lobbying them. Is that considered in this provision? And
these are not sales tax laws. These are the special laws such as lodging taxes, entertainment taxes.
In which other? Lodging and what other?
Lodging, well, anything other than local sales tax. It would be lodging, entertainment, admissions, food and beverage taxes. I mean, there could be other taxes as well, but I mean, those are examples.
Okay. Now this making me think of Representative Lesch's bill that I think we're also going to have to deal with this year on lodging. So I'd like to learn more about this provision and how that would interact. If the committee might recall that we had a big conversation on Representative Lesch's lodging bill, I think about the end of session, and we ultimately didn't decide anything. So maybe we can work on that a little bit.
Yeah. I wanted to say that this is important to the Department of Revenue and also to retailers. Because when there are inconsistencies between the sales tax chapter, as far as, you know, the definitions of terms and the special local laws, then there can be confusion, not only for the auditors, because if we're administering it, then we have two sets of books that we have to administer for sometimes for this very same transactions. For example, if someone is buying tickets to admission to an entertainment event, we would have the sales tax, and we would include in that, in the sales price, the cost of the ticket. You went to a ticket vendor. But if the local law didn't adopt the sales price definition and all they had was an admissions tax, then it would be administered differently. And so there's some confusion there. And it's hard on both the retailers and also on us when we're out there auditing. So.
Ms. Dalton, you want to jump in on this?
Madam Chair, I do think that this is really a good idea. We've allowed local governments that, for instance, have imposed restaurant taxes or food and beverage taxes to define the type of restaurant that it was that it applied to. And so they all have slightly subtle differences, and I don't think you want to continue doing that. I think you do want to, for administration purposes, particularly as we're making the department administer more and more of these, you want them to have the same tax base as the state. So if you are prepared food, the food and a local food and beverage tax applies to you. You know, we aren't going to be going around and saying a hot dog stand is subject to the food and beverage tax in St. Cloud but not in Duluth, for instance. You want to have the same thing.
Okay, so can I just ask Ms. Dalton, for example, in the Mall of America legislation that passed in 09 or 08, I can't recall, there's a menu of local amusement, liquor, lodging, food, beverage, you know, all kinds of stuff going on there. Was that kind of legislation already taken care of and all lined up in this regard, or creating more problems?
Madam Chair, I think I actually would have created more problems because I do believe that we said that they could define food and beverage tax
however they wanted. Yeah, okay. Thank you. Appreciate that. Representative Anderson, then Mallory.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you tell me, are there any cities that currently have a food and beverage tax or lodging tax that they're set to sunset so that the city needs to renew them, and then would this new provision apply?
Ms. Berry?
I'm sorry, I don't have the information right at hand as far as which ones are set to sunset, but if they are set to sunset and they come back to this body to have it extended, then under this law, that would cause them to, you know, to fall under this law so that they would need to adopt, you know, to be consistent with the sales tax statute.
Representative Anderson, further? No. Representative Mark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with Ms. Dalton that just like a rose is a rose is a rose, a hot dog is a hot dog is a hot dog, but entertainment is very different in different cities, and we have entertainment taxes, and I think when you start telling a city what they can define as entertainment, it's going to differ a lot between Minneapolis and St. Paul and Bloomington and Revere, Minnesota, or something like that. So I really don't understand how you can say an entertainment tax has to be whatever we set. I think that's got to be a local definition.
Ms. Berry?
Madam Chair, Representative, one thing that's important to note, too, is that This would be for those laws that the Department of Revenue administers. And we actually don't administer that many. Right. For instance, the lodging taxes, almost every city has lodging taxes, and we just administer a handful of those. We administer special local taxes for Mankato, for Minneapolis, Rochester, St. Cloud, and St. Paul. We don't administer Bloomington's, for example. They have all kinds of special local taxes. So as long as the department is not required to, as long as it's something where we need to come into agreement with the locality still has the option of administering it themselves. And so then having entertainment tax that's very different from any other locality, if they want to administer it themselves, then that wouldn't be an issue here.
Thank you. Representative Mallory?
Well, Madam Chair, I'm not sure if I totally agreed with the department on that. It would, if they're administering everything else for a city, to have one small tax administered separate might be pretty tough. Not sure.
Okay. Representative Coles.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the witness, could you help me understand why we should or shouldn't have the department administering these local taxes? I mean, it seems to me that if we're going to have local option sales taxes, this sort of cuts against the idea of letting a local community do what they want to do. I'm not a big fan of local option sales taxes to start with, but shouldn't we just tell communities that if you're going to impose a local option sales tax, that you need to administer it and get the department out of doing that for local communities? Wouldn't that solve the issue that the department's having in terms of having to apply different rules different places?
Ms. Berry.
Madam Chair, Representative, that would be one way to solve it, is to take the Department of Revenue out of it. I don't know if that's what the cities want. Because many of the cities, if they also have the local sales tax, which we're already administering. And so it's, as far as administrative burden for the retailers, if they only have to fill out one return, you know, to fill out for the state sales tax, local sales tax, and then also whatever local special tax they may have, and they can put it all in one return, then it can be a lot easier for them. So there are pros and cons.
And Representative Coles, you want to ask your same question to Ms. Dalton, who's figured out she just needs to join us now, because now Representative Reinert and Solberg have questions too, so she's at the table here.
Well, Madam Chair, I think that this highlights a policy issue for us. I'm not a big fan of local option sales taxes to start with, but you know, I'm not terribly sympathetic to local jurisdictions wanting additional administrative burden relief if they want to impose a sales tax. If they want to do it, they should do it. They should administer it. That's at least one policy choice we could make as a state. We haven't done that in the past. You know, we've got to figure out how we're going to deal with our $1.2 billion problem and the problems going forward. And I'm not sure that adding new burdens to the department or continuing existing burdens on the department is going to get us moving in the direction we need to go. So I don't need anything more. I just raised the issue, and I think we should think about it as we move forward.
Thank you. Representative Solberg.
Chair, my concern would be what kind of an extra burden we will put on the retailer. If we can relieve the retailer as well into one uniform type thing, I think that's a good thing to do.
Thank you. Representative Reinert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And directly to Representative Coles' point, and I don't recall the mechanics on this, but about 3 years ago, the city of Duluth was told by the state that it had to stop collecting, doing its own work. In fact, we had to budget an extra $400,000 into the city budget for the state to collect all our local sales taxes, and that we couldn't do it ourselves anymore. So I don't know the history. Somebody here probably does, but that policy choice was apparently made for local government a few years ago.
Representative Reinert, Ms. Dalton does know that, and that was in this committee. Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, Representative Reinert, under the streamlined sales tax law, any general local sales tax is required to be collected at the state level, and that is what affected Duluth. Regarding these other special local taxes, the food and beverage, the admissions, this really has to do with do we mitigate the cost of collection? If the department is collecting somebody's local sales, local food and beverage tax, the department actually keeps a portion of the money to cover their costs. So it's not that we're adding costs to the department. It makes some sense, economic sense, just for the same reason that we piggyback on the federal income tax, because then we can also piggyback on their audits and things like that. It makes sense for us to piggyback these local taxes on the state tax base, and it often makes sense to piggyback the administration on the state administration, because they can do audits simultaneously and things like that. So it may actually reduce the cost to the local governments to have it administered at the state level, but they are reimbursing the Department of Revenue when the Department of Revenue is collecting that local tax for them.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I was going to ask that very thing, whether the local governments pay, because I seem to remember that. So thank you. She anticipated my question.
Further discussion on this provision? Why, it's in the policy bill, and they're not all together in the technical bill. So thank you, Ms. Berry.
Please.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. My name is Pat Finnegan. I'll take you through Article 3, the special taxes article.
Okay. And members, I think we're going to have quite a bit of testimony on Article 4, so we want to get through 3 and get to 4 and get through 4 before we adjourn.
No.
Mr. Finnegan, please.
Madam Chair, Sections 1 and Sections 3 are similar. The Department is seeking authority to have the ability to cancel distributor licenses when they haven't been used for over a year. Section 1 is dealing with petroleum tax distributor licenses, and Section 4 is cigarette distributor licenses. Section 2 and 4 deal with the cigarette sales tax. If you look at Section 2, all that deleted language actually is being picked up in Section 4. And what the department is doing with these two sections is right now, to determine the annual cigarette sales tax, the department does a survey in the spring, publishes the rate by May 1st, that's effective August 1st. What we're trying to do is move that to a non-legislative time of the year. So what the proposal would be to end up having a survey done in the fall with a new rate published November 1st to be effective January 1st. So that's what Sections 2 and 4 do. Sections 5, 6, and 7 are insurance tax proposals. There isn't a...
Madam Chair, there's an amendment that you have in your packet. It's A10-2080, and that would be amending this section on the surplus lines.
Representative Loeffler, do you want to move the A10 to get it in the order?
I would move the A10 amendment.
Okay, so Representative Loeffler moves the A10 amendment to get in the order. The department would like it. Okay. There are two A10 amendments.
A10-2080.
So that is Representative Loeffler's motion, A10-2080, to get it in the form the department would like it. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion carries. Please.
Madam Chair, Section 5 deals with the insurance tax definition of gross premiums. And basically what we're doing here is just reorganizing the statute. So what the amendment does is it puts some little subparagraphs A, B, C, D in here, and puts in a separate definition of gross premiums for surplus lines. That's the last in the bill. It's on page 9, starting on page line 9.9. And what the amendment does there is cross out most of that language. The department met with the Commerce Department. We are basically just responsible for taxing the insurance industry, but the Commerce Department regulates it. So we met with the Commerce Department and with the people from the insurance industry, and that's what the language that we came up with here people agreed to. So in that final paragraph there, after the amendment, it'll just read, gross premiums for surplus lines insurance includes all charges, commissions, and fees received by the licensee. Gross premiums does not include the stamping fee as provided under Section 68-2085 sub 7, nor the operating assessment as provided under Section 68.208 subdivision 8.
Mr. Finnegan, has Representative Atkins been made aware of this change? Is the Commerce folks, are they up to snuff on this? And
I know the Commerce Department has worked with us, and they have some separate changes to some of the surplus lines provisions. I can't say whether they've worked with Representative Atkins.
Ms. Cadoon?
Madam Chair, no, I have not run this by Representative Atkins. We can certainly do that. This is, though, following what the Department of Revenue's current interpretation is of current law regarding how these should be taxed currently. Okay. It just needed more clarity in the statute.
It would be great if you could do that so he's aware of what the department's proposing. Representative Reiner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We can go back to the Section 1 and 3 changes. Could you help walk me through why, when it's a two-year license, we would cancel after 1 year and ordered in the in the comments from the department that it is meant to address tax evasion and lessen administrative burden, but I guess I'm not mentally making that connection.
Mr. Finnegan.
Section, Madam Chair, Representative, the Section 1 deals with the authority for the department to cancel distributor licenses for petroleum tax. Section 4 does the same thing, or Section 3, I mean, does the same thing for cigarette and tobacco products distributor licenses. The currently now, the department has the authority to revoke permits, but they'd have to go through an administrative hearing to do it. And normally it involves a situation where there's criminal activity or failure to pay taxes for a certain period of time. This would just give us the authority if returns aren't filed for a year or if they just file zero returns, that they're not operating as a distributor, we could cancel that license. Just particularly the tax evasion part would probably be more apparent in the cigarette distributor license, because when a party has a cigarette distributor license, they can go to another state and purchase cigarettes and tobacco products untaxed. And if they don't report that to us, we have no authority. You know, we don't know what they're doing with the license. So we think if they're not using the license, if they're not legally and they're not reporting those transactions to us, then we want to cancel that type of license.
Representative Reinert? Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Broad?
Madam Chair, I just would encourage the department on this section to maybe take a look at how it's written. I'm not a lawyer, but when I look at it with the amendment, and maybe it's how I haven't gotten through the entire amendment, I'm trying to cross out as we go, but the way I read it, we're saying that we're going to, everything is included, and then in the next section we're going to say but not these things. So which sentence actually supersedes the other is my question. It seems to me that if you're going to exclude things, you ought to say either but for or except for, as opposed to having two contradictory sentences backing up to each other. So I don't think we need to fix it, but it just seems to me that there's a lack of clarity. If we're trying to clarify, that might help.
Mr. Finnegan?
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, I think the part that are excluded, those are currently in law. So we're just referencing them, saying we're going to, the growth premiums for surface lines is going to be all the charges and fees that are received by these surface lines licensees. But we're not going to include the stamping fee, and we're not going to include this operating assessment. Those are already excluded. So it's just keeping that exclusion is the way I look at it. But we can look at the language.
Thank you. Are there further questions on this?
Madam Chair.
Please, yes.
Section 6, then, it simply deletes language that is now in Section 5. And Section 7 is deals with the statute of limitations for assessments for insurance taxes, normally 3.5 years after filing. And this would allow us, like many of our taxes, increased time to assess taxes when there's an omission by the taxpayer of 25% or more of the tax on the return.
Okay. Representative Coles.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize for hopping around, but I think Representative Reinert has raised a good point with the petroleum and cigarette distributor licenses. I guess the portion of the new proposed language that concerns me is subpart 2. You know, if somebody's not filing a tax return, I don't have a problem with the department canceling the license. If somebody's requesting that it be canceled, I'm not sure that I have a problem with it. But if for whatever reason, I mean, obviously the economy stinks and maybe somebody's taken a little pause from that portion of their business, but they don't want to give up the license just yet, but they file a tax return, they report zero liability, they're not ready to have it canceled because maybe their business plan says, I'm going to pick it up in another 6 months, as opposed to forcing them to go through the process to get relicensed. To me, that seems like we're putting an additional burden. So before I understand we're going to lay this over, I think that needs some additional work, and I think we should at least think about whether subpart 2 there is appropriate to, you know, have an administrative cancellation of the license as opposed to some more formal revocation process.
Thank you. And so it looks like we've got a few provisions so far that we need a little work on. Was that it from you, Mr. Finnegan? Appreciate it. I want to ask right now, because I forgot, is there any testimony on Articles 1, 2, or 3 before we start 4? Because I think most testimony is on 4. Is there anybody who wanted to speak to us about the department's proposals on 1, 2, or 3? Okay. Article 4. Welcome.
My name is Harriet Sims with the Department of Revenue, and I'm going to talk about Article 4. And if you look at Sections 1, Section 2, and also Section 8, they all refer to the issue of whether of assessor's testimony in court. Section 1 amends 82B035 subdivision 2, which is actually a commerce statute. That statute licenses appraisers, and it prohibits assessors from preparing appraisals or reports or testifying court on behalf with respect to properties in their jurisdiction. But under the current law, the assessors aren't required to be licensed as appraisers if they are employed and acting in their capacity as assessors for political subdivisions. This would amend it to specify that nothing in 82B would prohibit them from preparing appraisals or appraisal reports, and that would be a change to that statute. Section 2 then amends Minnesota Section 271-41 Subdivision 5 that deals with activities that are prohibited for assessors. And it lists a number of prohibited activities, and one of which is making appraisal reports and analyses in their own assessment jurisdictions. But then it also states that the current law states that it doesn't prohibit them from carrying out any duties required for proper assessment of property for property tax purposes. This came into the law in about 1993, and the department has always assumed, and the assessors have assumed, that making appraisals and testifying in court is part of assessors' duties, and assessors have done that for most of the last 16 years. So the change would be to specify that these activities are specifically assessors' duties. The reason this is coming about is there have been, that we know of, four court cases in the tax court. Three of them have been decided. One is yet to be decided, where objections were raised to assessors giving evidence in court as expert witnesses. And one of the cases, the court allowed it on procedural grounds because the objection was made too late. In the other two cases, the court looked specifically at 270-41. Subdivision 5 and ruled that there was not a specific exception for assessors testifying in court, and in fact ended up stating that if the legislature could have put that language in, they would have. And so that is our fix. We think that in 1993, and there is some legislative history, that the purpose of the prohibited activities statute was to prevent assessors from moonlighting in other jurisdictions. And the statute would not prohibit an assessor from performing these duties in another assessment jurisdiction rather than their own, but only in their own. When you get over to Section 8 is also a a change to 278.05 that deals with the tax court, and we're looking at that as kind of a conforming amendment. And this was also brought to our attention by the assessors. Would add a new subdivision that would require that appraisals or appraisal reports prepared by licensed assessors and testimony is admissible in evidence. Now, this doesn't affect whether or not the court wants to give it any weight or whether or not the court wants to treat it as expert testimony or as lay testimony. They could treat it any way that they wanted to. And one of the reasons it was brought to us by the assessors is because they anticipate that it would be quite expensive for them if they had to hire additional appraisers when they have people on board. And that's section, briefly, sections 1, 2, and 8.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Sims. I think we're going to stop before we ask you to go to the other parts of Article 4, because I think a lot of members are aware of this issue and are kind of hearing from both sides. So, Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. As mentioned, this could potentially be a pretty big cost to local units of government, and I don't know if someone from the assessors, I know Mr. May at a meeting, and I forget what that number was, but if cities and counties have to go out each time and hire appraisals done times by a number of cases they had before the tax court, someone help me out. There was a number quoted by Mr. May at a meeting. It was very significant. I mean, into the hundreds of thousands
Mr.
of
May
dollars.
Is right here.
Oh, there he is. I didn't see him. Very good.
Mr. May.
If he could come forward, Madam Chair, and answer that question and just kind of take us through what are the potential costs to local units of government in yours, for example.
Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, Tom May, representing Hennepin County. I think in our discussion, the number I use is appraisals typically, and this is just an average depending on the property, could run the county anywhere from $8,000 to $10,000 for a particular appraisal. Actually, in some of the bigger properties, appraisals can run up towards $15,000 or more. And then there would also include court costs, because then the appraiser would have to appear in court. And I think the bottom line is that counties and cities who try these cases already do hire appraisers to do them. There are staff appraisers, and we pay them for that work. So it's not like we don't have any cost. We already have them on staff to do that. But that was kind of the average numbers that we gave based on our experience of hiring outside appraisers.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. May, could you tell me how many typical tax court cases would you have, and what would be the additional cost versus what it's costing now if you have to do this?
Mr. May, so 10 to 15,000 each time times how many cases?
Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, for 2009, Hennepin County had about 1,860 tax court petitions filed. Now, those aren't all commercial, industrial, but the majority of them are. And if we had to hire appraisers for outside appraisals for all those cases, you could see what the numbers would be. I guess we haven't done the analysis to see what the difference is between a staff appraiser doing it and the outside appraiser, but I think it would be significant.
So, Marquardt, further?
Just one other question, not for Mr. May, but this effective date would be, I don't quite understand, final, can you tell, are we going retroactive, and is it going to impact cases currently in the mix, so to speak, or when's the effective date, and how would that affect cases that are currently in process, I guess?
Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, it potentially could. As I understand it, right now there aren't any cases yet that have gone to trial outside of the four that we know of, because they're being held. So, but theoretically, potentially, if a case, say, went to trial last week, evidence was offered, and the court, following the cases, did not allow the testimony. And then this legislation passed, and one of the parties filed an appeal, then it could potentially apply.
Okay. So Representative Coles has a question, and Representative Liebling, but before Mr. May leaves, I don't know if Representative Coles was going to ask you a question, or Ms. Sims, or someone else, but I just, can you, just for the sake of the committee, for those who don't track this as closely, can you tell us the differences in private appraisers, assessors, and public assessors and public appraisers, and the training of these folks? I think legislators often confuse these concepts, and assessors and appraisers mean really different things to legislators depending what part of the state they represent, and so I think there's often a misunderstanding of these different roles. So if you could just, from your, I think you used to be the president of the state assessors or something, didn't you? I'm figuring you're the guy who could define these terms for us.
Madam Chair, I'll try. Assessors have long been licensed by the State Board of Assessors, who is an agency set up in statute who deals with not only the training that the assessors are required to have, but the courses, the content, and so forth. So once you're licensed as either a certified Minnesota assessor, accredited or senior accredited, depending on the level, different courses are required. So you are trained and are proficient in both mass appraisal and individual appraisal. It's a requirement, so they have those requirements. Also, many of our assessors are also have designations from the International Association of Assessing Officers, which is, of course, a founding member of the Appraisal Foundation, with certain requirements to meet those designations. So there is a myriad of training that assessors have. And outside appraisers, of course, are governed by a different agency. They're governed by the Department of Commerce, where they have to meet certain standards. And that's why the Commerce Statute, when it was passed, specifically has an exemption for assessors, because we're licensed and trained under a different statute. The methods of appraisal, the techniques of appraisal, are the same on either side. And when you go to tax court, the requirements are the same of both sides as far as producing a quality appraisal that meets USPAP standards and is credible. And as was mentioned previously, once those appraisals are in court, the court has discretion as to whether or not they accept any of the appraisal or part of it and how much weight they put on each part. So both sides have to meet that standard.
Thank you. Representative Coles.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. May, thank you, except I think with Section 8 we're saying that the county's assessment is automatically admissible now, and I'm not sure that, first of all, I'm not sure that this committee really should be making that kind of a determination. I trust, Madam Chair and Representative Mallory, that if this bill does move out of this committee, that it's going to take a stop in Representative Mallory's committee. I mean, we're talking about standards of evidence and what's going to be introduced when and how. And those are issues that I think are, at least in my time previously as a member of the Civil Law Committee, those are things that we always took a look at, just like this committee always takes a look at tax issues. So I don't know if Representative Mallory is going to want to see this bill or not. I hope he does. And Madam Chair, I guess I would note that this effective date, and I think Representative Marquardt raised the issue, to me is very peculiar. It's peculiar in how it's written. And it absolutely would take in cases that are currently pending. Typically, when we change standards, at least the most common practice is that we apply things for causes of action that happen on a date sometime in the future or that are filed after the statute becomes effective. This would turn back the clock on things that are already being litigated. And I know there was reference to four cases that have been litigated. I believe at least one and maybe more of them are on appeal right now. And so it seems to me that we have the department, or the assessors at least, using the department to come in and sort of change the rules of the game, at halftime. And I'm not comfortable with that, and I hope that Representative Mullery will take a close look at this issue if it does come out of here and request the bill come to his committee.
Thank you. Representative Liedling.
Well, Madam Chair, this must really be my day because I was going to say something really along the same lines, and I was going to ask Representative Mullery if he was going to take a look at this because, you know, maybe it's the attorneys in the room are thinking that along the same lines. I think when you come in and in this bill change the rules of evidence, you're opening a can of worms, and this is really ambiguous to me what it would mean when it was actually in court, so I'll defer to Representative Mullery if he wants to address that.
Representative Mullery.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and obviously we're going to have to see this, and I kind of wonder how well thought out this is because I'm reading the last sentence in the first, or in Section 1, and it's not even a sentence. So I don't think, I've asked someone else, we don't think it's a sentence, so maybe some things need to be sorted out here.
I think we got the answer there, that part. Representative Coles,
Madam Chair, I just want to assure my Republican colleagues that although I've agreed with Representative Reinert, and now I'm hearing some kumbaya from other DFL members, that the knock I got on my head hasn't changed me. I'm still who I
Come
was
on
before.
Over. Come on over. You know you want to. Okay, thank you. And we do have a number of people here, I believe, who wanted to speak to this this proposal, so we want to hear from you. Representative Broad.
I just have a question for Mr. May before I leave.
Yes, please.
You mentioned the USPAP standards. Do assessors actually abide by USPAP within their assessment practices?
Mr. May.
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, when we appear in tax court, the issue always comes up that the standards are applicable to our appraisals as well as the other side. So that is a debate in tax court on many, almost all the cases, yes.
And Madam Chair and Mr. May, if it comes up, but how is it actually worked through? So assessors do not do 15 hours of USPAP every assessment licensing.
Mr. May,
No, our requirements are, as I stated before, established by the State Board of Assessors, but there are ethics and those types of courses included, so our appraisers are required on a certain timely basis to complete those types of courses.
Representative Brown.
And Madam Chair, what I'm trying to get to is for an appraisal report to be identified as an appraisal report by appraisers, licensed appraisers, they have to have the USPAP standards held contained within that report and abide by those standards. So when an assessor completes an assessment report or an assessor appraisal report, which is different than an appraiser report, it's getting confusing, what standards then? It's just an assessment standard that is used for those appraisal reports? I mean, there's a big difference between assessment reports and appraisal reports in terms of how they're used on the open market. And so what I'm trying to get to is an apples-to-apples comparison for an expert witness. So you have an expert witness in there who's doing an appraisal report with appraisal standards. How is that compared to somebody who's completing an appraisal report through assessment standards?
Mr. May.
Madam Chair, Representative Broad, let me just step back one second because the word assessment and appraisal seems to get mixed up. First of all, when we appear in tax court, the assessment that's been established is prima facie valid. That's the starting point. So the two appraisals that come into the court case in front of the judge are going to establish whether that initial assessment is supported or it's changed, and they'll make that decision based on the credibility of the evidence provided in the two appraisals. I can only speak for Hennepin County, but I would say that the appraisals that our staff appraisers prepare and bring into tax court are USPAP compliant as far as the requirements of USPAP, or that'll be noted where they would be lacking. So one of the requirements of USPAP is that you fully disclose exactly what the appraisal is doing and how you follow the different criteria.
Right. And Madam Chair, Mr. May, and how it's used, that's part of USPAP as well. So what I'm trying to get at as far as an expert witness, an appraiser has licensing requirements that are similar, it looks like, to assessors in terms of the training piece of it. 90 hours is what it used to be, and I think over the past number of years, appraisers have had their hours jacked up quite significantly in terms of the requirements. And I don't know that assessors have had their hours increased equivalently to where appraisers are now at. So beyond that, there's also a experience requirement of appraisers to be considered as expert witnesses for taxpayers. And so the experience level that assessor appraiser might have or an internal appraiser might have in regards to an individual appraisal versus a mass appraisal system is what I'm trying to understand in terms of that expert witness apples to apples comparison for the tax court.
Can I just jump in there before you answer that in following what you're saying, I think? Wouldn't that vary dramatically, too, depending on the county? I mean, I'm trying to put my assessor into the scenario that Representative Broad just walked through and think through what those folks, what their experience would be to the individual property versus the mass. And wouldn't that vary across the state in sort of the complexity and the detail of the different subdivisions they're working in?
Madam Chair, the State Board of Assessors determines, depending on the scope of the work to be done in each jurisdiction, what level of certification or licensure the assessor needs. So, for instance, in your district, it would be a senior accredited, the top licensure. And in some other maybe more rural districts, it might be a lesser licensure, depending on the amount of work. Madam Chair, Representative Broad, to answer your question, the International Association of Assessing Officers is a founding member of the Appraisal Foundation. In fact, the IAAO just sent in a new proposal, and it's been accepted by the Appraisal Foundation, increasing the hours required for designations and changing some of the education experiences. And I do have a letter from the chair of the USPAP Committee for the Appraisal Foundation that specifically states under USPAP that it's fully anticipated that assessors or ad valorem people do both mass appraisals and individual appraisals. And in that regard, they're subject to standards 1 and 2 if they're doing an individual appraisal, or they're subject to standard 6 if they're doing a mass appraisal. So, yes, I mean, there is that intertwining
And Mr. Mayor, I appreciate that. What I'm trying to get to, though, is when we're talking about the appraisal and whether your appraiser, your staff appraiser, could go out and do an appraisal outside of the jurisdiction that they're in. So say Hennepin County, if you have a staff appraiser, I think this was mentioned in the opening statement, that they could go out and do an appraisal elsewhere. Well, they can't unless they're a licensed appraiser. And so they can only do an assessor, they can only create appraisals through the assessment realm within the jurisdiction of their hire unless they are a licensed appraiser. And so they're two very different things in terms of their capability to be considered an expert witness outside that jurisdiction of the of where they're hiring. And maybe that's confusing, but that's a concern of mine. It's a pretty significant concern. The last concern I have, that, and then we can just tee it off. I have a concern over the section, as you can probably imagine. Is the consideration of this disparate burden. I mean, we're concerned about the local governments. I think that's a fair concern. But what we need to keep in mind is that we're also talking about an even burden for the taxpayer, for the actual taxpayer themselves. The taxpayer has to go out and hire an appraiser. Mm-hmm. The taxpayer has to pay the court costs for that appraiser. And yet, the local government can absorb that through the system that they already have. Why wouldn't this inadvertently send more cases to court if the taxpayer has a burden that the local government doesn't necessarily have in terms of hiring that outside help, hiring that outside person at $350 a pop for an expert witness? So I'm concerned about the disparate burden, and I don't think I need a response to that. I'm just throwing it out there in terms of our view of this shouldn't be just from the view of the local government, which I think is important, but it also should have the view of the local of the taxpayer too.
Thank you. We're going to go to Representative Lanning, then we want to hear from folks who are here to talk to us about this provision. Representative Lanning.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a point of clarification here, Mr. May. are you in effect saying that that if we don't make this change, that because of the recent court case, that cities, counties are now going to have to always go to the outside to hire an appraiser and not be able to use even those who are certified appraisers that are on their staff? Is that what you're saying?
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, that's our opinion of the language and of the court decisions. Yes, that we'd have to hire outside appraisers on each case that was going to tax court. Yes.
Representative Lanning.
Well, that doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense to me, that if the issue is having a certified appraiser, why wouldn't an in-house appraiser do the job? That doesn't seem to make sense, but there are a lot of things in the law that don't make sense.
And Representative Lanning worked really hard on unfunded mandates last year, so this could be the new one. Mr. May?
Madam Chair, if I can make one more point of clarification with Representative Broad's question. Nothing in the language envisions assessors who work in a certain jurisdiction being able to be expert witnesses outside of their jurisdiction. The language specifically says within their jurisdiction.
Okay.
That's what we're talking about.
Okay, that helps clarification.
Madam Chair.
Representative Broad.
Well, yes, I'm aware of that, and I appreciate the clarification. I think it's a good one to have on the table. But what I'm saying is that we're going to consider this appraiser an expert only in the jurisdiction of their hire when they're not able to be considered an expert anywhere else. And so my question is whether it's more of an apples-to-apples question, is that you have somebody who's an expert in one situation when there's no way they could be an expert outside of that jurisdiction. And so that's my concern. I'm aware that they're only an expert in that jurisdiction, but it still doesn't seem like an apples-to-apples comparison, and that's what I'm trying to get to in terms of the expert testimony. Yeah.
Thank you. Others, we'd like to hear from you before we adjourn. We got some calls. Maybe you've changed your mind now listening to the debate. Did folks want to talk to us either for or against the department's proposal here? Welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair and representatives. My name is Gina DeConcini. I represent the tax section of the State Bar Association. I have with me Larry Martin, who is a member of the bar, who is also a licensed appraiser and a former assessor. Mainly in case you have deep technical questions, he will be the person, hopefully, to address those too. I'm here today because the tax law section opposes these portions of 2972. The tax section of the Bar Association believes that allowing licensed assessors who are not licensed as real property appraisers to provide expert testimony regarding appraisal methodology and to submit property appraisals in tax court is not fair to taxpayers, and it does override the rules of evidence that are currently in place. Ms. Sims testified, this legislation is put in place right now to override recent tax court decisions, both of which held that unlicensed appraisers who work for the assessor's office were not entitled to testify as expert witnesses. They were allowed to testify as lay witnesses, but not as expert witnesses, or to provide appraisal reports as appraisal reports to the court. We believe that these decisions were properly interpreted under existing law, and that to put the new sections in place would in fact be a major override to the existing law. It is not just a clarification of what's always been there, what was meant, that this would really represent a very big change to the laws of evidence as they currently are in place. Specifically, line 1330, this is the section 8 piece, which specifically says if you're a licensed assessor, your testimony can be expert testimony. Specifically says your testimony, your appraisal report can be admitted as appraisal report. That is absolutely new law that is not in place currently, and is specifically, right now, that would not be allowed by taxpayers. Right now, the law is the same, really, for taxpayers and for the state. Both sides, that would not be admissible as an appraisal report if it were admitted by somebody who was not an appraiser. Right now, this law would say it is admissible if it's on the behalf of the state, but that same report prepared by even that same person, moonlighting or otherwise, would not be admissible by the taxpayer. And we think that that change in law, to basically say what is currently equal and fair, to make the law say we are going to make unequal and balanced towards the state opposed to the taxpayer, is something that we as the Bar Association, and we as the tax section of the Bar Association, thinks is not an improvement to our current law. That's essentially, I mean, if you really want to boil it down, I think Representative Brode made most of the points that, you know, that I intended to make this morning, which were basically, I'm here on behalf of the taxpayers to say right now, especially small taxpayers, many times they're going to court to fight a few thousands of dollars worth of difference in property tax evasions. The smaller they are, the harder it is for them to be there. And really, the state does get assessors currently, get appraisers currently, when there's a lot of money on the table. So we're already dealing with appraiser to appraiser for the big taxpayers. It's the small taxpayers who did have to go out and spend more, in some cases, on their appraisal report than they're fighting in taxes, just to make their point. They're the ones who are now going to be up against the other side providing a report that did not require the same standard of evidence, and we think that that's unfair. I think that that pretty much summarizes, you know, our point. It's basically we think the law as it is currently written is fair because it provides the same level of evidence for both sides.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. DeConcini. What I want to do is get through the testimony without taking questions from members. We have a Baker, Bedore, and Mr. Martin. Did you want to add anything to what was just said? And I'm not aware of who else would like to speak, but we'd like to try to get to it before we have to adjourn.
I do have one other.
Yes.
Quick point of clarification,
sure.
If I could, Madam Chair.
Sure.
And that is that Mr. May testified that there are 1,800 petitions filed, and in terms of doing the math of what this might cost, the vast majority of petitions that are filed do not go to full court. They do not have a full hearing. We're not talking about 1,800 times this number. We're only talking about the very small minority of cases that actually go to full trial where we're in the world of the rules of evidence.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. Mr. Martin?
Madam Chair, I was just here to answer any technical questions. I do have an understanding of some of these fiscal issues. If the committee would like to ask some questions about that later, I'll stay in the back of the room.
And I think it's clear to folks that this is something that the committee is going to have to spend more time on to figure this out, what's going to go forward. So we may be asking you. So we appreciate you being here.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. We have a Mr. Baker and Mr. Bedore on our list. If you'd like to come forward and tell us what you're thinking, we'd appreciate hearing from you. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Stephen Baker. I'm the Ramsey County Assessor, and I'm here as a member of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers Legislative Committee. We have a good chunk of our committee here today because we have a number of new members, so today's our was prearranged to be our kind of legislative day.
How's it going?
And
we like that. We appreciate you being here.
The timing, it's pretty, I don't know, I guess you could look at it as good and or bad. I think this issue, it's complex because there's a number of points involved here, and I think we can certainly get off track with this a little bit. I would disagree a little bit with Ms. DeConcini's portrayal of the issues in the sense that the court has not really, in the first case, in oral arguments or from the bench, they talked about licensing, but in the written decisions, they really have focused on the prohibited activity statute, which is in the assessor's section of the law, and I think as Ms. Sims testified, was initially written to prohibit assessors from moonlighting in doing private appraisals in their jurisdictions. That was perceived, I think, rightfully as a conflict of interest and could certainly create some cynicism and serve to undermine the credibility of the assessors around the state. So they prohibited that. Now the courts have looked at it more recently. So for all these years, assessors have testified in all sorts of appeals, whether they be local boards, county boards, written appraisals for abatement applications. We used to have state board of assessor hearings, I think, before my time, and in tax court, both small claims division and regular division. Now, most recently, the court has held that, no, this is a prohibited activity. And I think it gets down really to, the focus shouldn't be around licensure. The focus should be on what are the duties of the assessor. And clearly, performing an independent valuation after we've completed the basic assessment of a property is critical to the proper performance of our duties. You know, I think my office gets we're going to have probably about 12 or 1,300 tax court petitions this year. We probably do another close to another 1,000 reviews based on phone calls and letters we get from taxpayers. Under the court's interpretation of the prohibited activity statute, all those review appraisals are not allowed. So it isn't just an idea that my appraisers can't testify or my assessors can't testify in tax court. If you extend the court's ruling, it would say that we can also not perform evaluation of a property after we've generated that initial assessment, whether that be for local board, county board, or abatements, that this is a prohibited activity. And clearly, I don't think that that's where Minnesota wants to go. It really undermines the procedures that we've had. In terms of the courts accepting the appraisals by assessors as having equal weight to private appraisers, I think they've always had that ability to weigh the appraisals, and certainly the attorneys for petitioners can suggest that appraisals provided by assessment witnesses have issues, and the court should consider those shortcomings, and the court typically has done that over the years. Even since the court has gone down this prohibited activity ruling, they have allowed appraisals by assessors to be admitted in a small claims court. So the concern that the smaller taxpayers are going to be really particularly hard hit here, I think, is not really relevant. I think basically small claims right now is unchanged. And if we have a case, if my office has a case in small claims court, our expectation is that our assessor can testify in that case, and that the courts have not disallowed that, at least up to this point. So, you know, I think all those things point to that. We have a long, as mentioned here earlier, we've got a long history of licensing for assessors and training in the principles and procedures of appraisal that really predate private appraisers. I was a private appraiser before I became an assessor. That was prior to commerce licensing of private appraisers. I had to take additional training to become an assessor at that point. But the classes that I took to become a private appraiser counted towards my assessor's license because they were the same courses on appraisal principles and procedures and income valuation, those kinds of things. The performance of the review appraisal is an important and integral part of the assessment process and really is critical, I think, to a fair and equitable property tax system in Minnesota. What we tell our taxpayers frequently is that when we send out the value notice, that's really our quality control check to our taxpayers. We do our best in a mass appraisal environment to put an accurate value on every parcel. That's not always possible. It's not going to happen. So when we send that notice out, we want somebody to look at that value and call us if they think it's not correct. And at that point, then we need to perform an independent valuation of that property to ascertain whether or not their concern is relevant and has merit or not. We need to maintain the ability to continue to do that work. And as we've said, the court maintains all their ability to continue to weigh the testimony. I think there's been some concern about whether or not these proposed changes would require an appraisal by an assessor to be admitted. I think it says that they're admissible, I believe. It doesn't say that they will be admitted. So the court, they're admissible, but the court could still not admit them because they have shortcomings on the quality of the appraisal itself. And I think with that, that's...
Okay, we want to... Is there anyone else who wants to talk to us before we adjourn? So we can get all the testimony on the tape here. Okay, can I ask Representative Broad to move the minutes of the 9th, 15th, and the 16th so we can get them posted? Representative Broad moves the minutes of the 9th, 15th, and 16th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion carries. Please, we have to adjourn at 12, so we'd really like to get your testimony. Fire away. You can come back to the next one, too, but we're trying to get you all through. We're going to have to take this up again. Clearly, we haven't even gotten to the bill. Please.
Thank you. My name is Steve Bedore.
Welcome.
I'm reluctantly shouldering the burden representing taxpayers here. I'm the Bedore of Bedore versus Hennepin County, one of two cases, the only two cases I know of, maybe I've heard three today, in which the courts have ruled that the assessor is prohibitive by 270.41 subdivision 5 to act as an appraiser. And I'm the only one of those in which the court allowed that assessor to testify and give an appraisal. Based upon the questions I've heard here, a quick lap through my case, which we're not going to do today, will address those concerns and I think shed quite a bit of light in terms of consequences, hopefully unintended consequences, but this definitely has an impact from a taxpayer standpoint. So I'm sorry I can't do it in 2 minutes.
Get what you can get in.
I'll take a pause.
Okay.
And I'll wait, and I'll make a trip back next time we do this.
Okay, we're planning on doing, Mr. Bedard, and sorry about that. We have two bills up today, the policy bill and the technical bill. Haven't even started on the technical bill, not through the policy bill, because we're on this provision. So we do want to give members, these are the way these two bills are, is they come from the executive branch, and they are from the executive branch, and we let legislators kind of take their stab at all the provisions. And obviously, if legislators can come to an agreement on them, then we carry them in the omnibus tax bill. If they can't, we drop them. But we're going to have to take another day on these bills. So we're going to come back on Monday.
Is that right?
Monday, and we'll just start up right here on Article 4. And I believe the committee meeting is at 2:45. However, we always have the floor before that, and for folks who don't come around here much, you know, we don't control when we get off the floor. So if we're not off the floor on time, then it gets delayed, but our plan is to be at 2:45 on Monday, and we'll just start up again on Article 4. And Mr. Bedard, you're first up if you're here. So
I will
we do want to hear your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you all. We are adjourned.